Okay, so last class we looked at some models of interaction between the electromagnetic field and two-level systems. And so our system was essentially defined by a spin one-half particle or a two-level system in an external magnetic field, which creates a splitting. So this becomes the natural energy eigenbasis of the system. You'll hear about experimentalists calling this the quantization axis, by which they mean the energy eigenbasis of the natural system. And then we applied a driving field in the XY plane of the following form. So in the NMR setup, we imagine this to be a magnetic field that's rotating in the XY plane. And it's rotating with the frequency omega. And the strength of the field, as well as the coupling to the system, is contained in this single parameter omega 1. And then kind of what you can expect from your recollection of electromagnetism is that having this mechanical motion of a magnetic field that's sweeping in the XY plane at a frequency omega generates radiation at a frequency omega, which then can interact with the two-level system if that radiation has a frequency that's comparable to omega naught. In fact, we defined the detuning delta, which was the difference between omega and omega naught. So essentially, the system has a natural frequency. This defines a natural frequency for the system, which is its Larmor precession. And then if we drive, this is the driving field. And then we have H1 is the driving field. And the driving field is able to, because sigma x is sigma plus plus sigma minus, it's able to induce transitions in between up and down, spin up and spin down. So in this way, with these two fields, one can control the spin and drive it anywhere on the block sphere that we wanted. And then we went on to look at modeling dissipation, noise, or spontaneous emission, whatever you want to call it. Those are all terms that spontaneous emission is a type of noise. Noise from the viewpoint that you want the system to remain pure and coherent, but it inhibits you from achieving that. And we did a phenomenological model of the decoherence with the block equations, where we added these gamma 1 and gamma 2 factors. Now what we're going to do for the latter half of the lecture is look at a more general theoretical framework for describing different types of noise, amplitude damping and dephasing, and we'll look at that in both the cross-operator picture and something called the Lindblad form, which is related to dynamical semigroups. So there's some interesting mathematics there about semigroups, and we'll try and power through all of that today. But before I get to that, I wanted to tell you about one more thing that'll be useful for you, which is understanding that generating this kind of magnetic field, which is rotating in the XY plane, is technologically very difficult. What's easy to do, so let's call this H1 rote now. So H1 rote of T is technologically difficult to create. It arises naturally when we're driving an atom with a laser. And remember, this Hamiltonian system for the NMR experiment was essentially identical to the Hamiltonian system describing an atom driven by a laser. So it's the same mathematics, two different physical setups. And it turns out nowadays that everyone's trying to build qubits with whatever their favorite quantum systems are, whether that be superconducting circuits or atoms in a cavity or NMR spins. This is the model that describes the way we control qubits. But so it's difficult to create this rotating driving field. So instead, but it's easy to create, and what they actually do in the lab is create a field of this form, where there's just an X component that's oscillating back and forth. So now imagine you have a magnetic field that's oscillating back and forth along the X-axis. So what I want to show you today is in a certain parameter limit, which is realistic and practical, that essentially these two forms give the same results. And that's called the rotating wave approximation. So the rotating wave approximation allows us to replace the theoretically clean but technologically difficult driving Hamiltonian with a theoretically slightly less clean but technologically feasible Hamiltonian. And in fact, I think I already have a typo. I think what we're going to do is we're going to drop the factor of 2 here to establish the equivalence. Because you can think of this as having two driving fields, one that's oscillating along X and one that's oscillating along Y. And so by just having one oscillating field to show that they're the same, we want to double the strength of this driving field just so our parameters match up in the end. So using the same notation as previously, where we define delta to be the difference in the populations, and R to capture the off-diagonal coherence, we get for H equals H0 plus H1 oscillation, we get d by dt of delta is equal to 2i omega 1 r bar minus r cos omega t. And then here we'll do it with the phenomenological dissipation due to spontaneous emission. And now what we're going to do is we're going to go to the rotating frame. So what does that mean? Basically, remember, the natural Hamiltonian H0 induces a Larmor precession. So the spins are actually physically precessing about this Z magnetic field. So it's convenient for analysis to go into a frame which is rotating at that frequency. Actually, we're going to go into a frame that's rotating at the driving frequency, omega, which is close to that frequency typically. So we're going to go into the frame that's rotating at frequency omega of the driving field. So that corresponds to defining r prime equal to r e to the plus I omega t. Yes. Yes. Now notice that we don't have to apply this rotation to delta, capital delta. Does anyone see a simple reason why that is? So what does delta correspond to? The difference in the populations. If I'm looking at the Z populations and I'm rotating in the XY plane, what effect does that have on the populations? Okay, I'm in the lab frame. You're in a rotating frame. We're describing the population of the up state. Is there going to be a difference in our description? Right, they're invariant under rotations. But the off-diagonal coherence, which represents essentially a phase between x up and down, that will be affected by what you call the phase in the xy plane will be different from what I call the phase in the xy plane because you're rotating in the xy plane. So that's why this is all we have to do to effect that change of, in this special notation with delta and r, this is all we have to do to account for the fact that we're going into a rotating frame. So basically the trick will be, well, we'll expand the cosine in the usual way, which is, I think, e to the I plus omega t. Does anyone remember if I've got my signs right here? Is that a plus? It's plus. And substitute. And then what we get, this is a bit long to write out, so bear with me. But then you'll see the nature of the approximation explicitly. R prime bar the T1 process is unaffected by this. And then we have dr prime by dt is equal to plus I omega r prime minus I omega naught r prime minus I omega 1 over 2 times delta e to the I omega t plus e to the minus I omega t times e to the minus I omega t minus gamma 2 r prime. So then the RWA involves dropping terms that oscillate off resonance. So we're going to get pairs where we have e to the minus I omega t times e to the minus I omega t and e to the plus I omega t times e to the plus I omega t, which takes omega to 2 omega. Now remember, a critical part of the driving field being physically relevant is that you want the driving frequency omega to be close to omega naught. Otherwise, the system won't feel the driving field. It'll be off resonance, very similar to resonance in classical physics. So what happens is that these terms with the factor of 2 omega are essentially off resonance, and so they become physically negligible. That's the key idea. And so therefore, mathematically, we're justified in dropping them. Yeah, so I think, remember, okay, so.
If so, what is that operation?
So I think what it is, it involves, you want a rotation about the z-axis. I suppose it's something like this. And then if you're describing rho in the rotating frame, so rho at time t in the rotating frame, which is our prime frame, would be equal to, and I almost for sure will get the sign wrong. Well, I have a 50% chance of getting it right. And then, well, this is kind of what you needed to think about to see the answer to my earlier question. And then, the difference between rho and rho prime, if you write it out in terms of this matrix elements, obviously rho 1 and rho 0 are invariant. But r, which is the off-diagonal term, is not invariant. Basically, remember that rho 1, if you have an eigenstate of sigma x, rho 1 will be something like I think it's plus 1. And then if you have a sigma y eigenstate, rho 1 is I. So basically, rho 1 is some complex number on the unit circle. And where it is on the unit circle depends on whether you're an eigenstate of x or y or somewhere in between. And then you get some phase that's not pi over 2. So it's, and so that this is going to generate a varying phase in that off-diagonal term. This one?
Yeah.
This should be a minus? That may well be true. Of course, it doesn't matter which way you do it for the result, but this is plus or minus. Okay, let me just put it, I don't think there's much value in me figuring this out right now, so I'll just alert you to the fact that this may be a minus. And either way, we'll get the same answer. It's just a matter of whether, actually no, we have to be rotating in the right direction. So only one of them is correct, because you want to be rotating with the driving field. So this may be a minus. Was there another question? We're just describing the system in a rotating frame. Well, I mean, when you're saying we and so on, I mean, there's a lab frame. And then you can, I mean, like in classical physics, I can describe my physics in any reference frame I want to describe it in. And so I'm imagining describing it from the point of view of somebody that's actually rotating. A frame of reference that's rotating about the z-axis is what it means to go to the rotating frame. Oh, I see. Like you're worried about like Coriolis forces. Like you get fictitious forces when you do this classically. Well, given that what we're doing is exactly this, you can just deduce what the consequences are. And the only consequence is that your definition of R changes. That seems to be the net.
I mean, here, this is a rotating frame.
Well, I don't think he was really worried about Coriolis forces, but whether there's other, you're concerned about showing that there's no other spurious effects that are introduced, or yeah, or any other kind of changes. I mean, I guess the answer is, I don't think so. I mean, this is, I mean, what could matter? I mean, basically, we have, all we're doing is this change of reference point, and so now we can write down the von Neumann equation in this reference frame, and it's d rho prime by dt is equal to rho prime commutator with h. And so then h, for self-consistency, you'd want to describe h in the rotating frame. This term won't be affected, but this term will. And the result of that is to give you these additional terms in here. So I think it's self-consistent, but maybe later, if you can just go through it and see if you're happy with that and talk to me about it. So the key kind of physical insight is that these terms that have double the frequency can be neglected. And then, so after dropping these terms, we recover which you can check is where we were, which basically where we recover the model with H1 rho. Yes, Nicole.
So I'll show you a figure that shows you the exact dynamics without the approximation and the result after the approximation. And you'll see what it is. They're both rapid and small, these extra oscillations. So I'm just going to sketch some MATLAB plots where you can look at, for example, the expectation of sigma y. And what you get is so under the rotating wave approximation, you get your usual sinusoidal evolution.
in time. So this is with RWA, and then without invoking the rotating wave approximation, you get the exact dynamics due to this this type of driving. And what it does, okay, this is gonna challenge my artistic skills here. So you get this kind of rapid small oscillation on top of the, so the frequency of the oscillation is faster, and the magnitude of the oscillation is due to the fact that it's off resonance, so it has a negligible effect on the dynamics of the system. And this is under kind of exaggerated. This is where we just have one order of magnitude. This is where, so these figures are with omega not equal omega equal 100 megahertz. And the driving field omega 1 has a strength of 10 megahertz, which is just 10 times smaller. But the physically realistic scenario is where you have omega naught equal to omega equal to 100 megahertz as before, but you have omega 1 equal to 100, say 100 kilohertz. And then you can't even see these oscillations. So as long as the driving force is weak compared to the intrinsic frequency of the system, the approximation is much better. So under these conditions, which are physically realistic, the effect is invisible to the naked eye. Invisible on the scale of the figure. I'll say almost invisible. That's how good your eyesight is. Okay, good. So that's something that I can just end there with that, unless there's any other questions. And we can move on to some of the theory of open systems. Oh, that's good. Yeah, perfect. Good. Okay, so what we've seen already to model open systems are, we've seen that Krauss operators provide a means of modeling or describing open system effects over a discrete time interval. So I have an input state and an output state, and that's associated with some given fixed amount of time. So there we have that any completely positive trace preserving map and we'll call such a map lambda, which is a linear map that takes linear operators on the Hilbert space two linear operators on the Hilbert space. Can be expressed in Krauss form. AK dagger AK has to be equal to identity. This is the trace preserving condition. So an example of a Krauss operator is amplitude damping. So amplitude damping is a model of inducing transitions between up and down for the system due to its interactions with other quantum degrees of freedom. And for amplitude damping on the qubit, we have Krauss operators A0 equal to 1, 0, 0, 1 minus gamma, and A1 equal to 0, square root of gamma, 0, 0. With gamma in the interval 0, 1. And then one has rho prime equals lambda rho. For the amplitude damping, and you can just directly do the matrix multiplications, and what you find is you get rho 0, 0 plus gamma rho 1, 1. 1 minus gamma rho 0, 1. 1 minus gamma times rho 1, 0. 1 minus gamma rho 1, 1. So your population of the excited state, which is the one state, decreases for each application of this map, decreases by an amount 1 minus gamma, and the population of the ground state increases. So here we've modeled essentially spontaneous emission to the ground state, where I hope it's clear that rho 0, 0 and rho 1 are the matrix elements of the original input state. Another important model is phase damping. So one thing that one might be able to do in the tutorial or on an assignment is to show that basically in the continuous time limit, the amplitude damping Krauss operators gives rise to essentially a T1 process. So we saw that phenomenological model of T1 and gamma 1 in the case of the two-level atom. And this amplitude damping is associated with that process. Now, phase damping is associated with dephasing of the off diagonals which is essentially loss of coherence without affecting the populations. In the eigenbasis. Rho 0, 0, and rho 1, 1. So I'll give you a model for that in a minute. And I'll just remind you again, because I mentioned this last lecture, but it's worth hearing again. You can have pure dephasing, which gives rise, so this gives rise to a T process, T2 process, gives rise to T2 processes. So T2 processes can exist without any T1, but whenever you have a T1 process, that always induces some T2. So you can see that here. Notice that what we really wanted to model was a change in the populations due to, say, spontaneous emission. And it turns out you can prove that it's impossible to do that without also attenuating the off diagonal. Yes?
What is the T1?
Those are just names for two different types of physical processes. So an example of a T1 process is spontaneous emission. Basically, a T1 process changes the probabilities in the energy eigenbasis. And a T2 process leaves the probabilities in the energy eigenbasis the same, but destroys the coherence between them. And so it's just the terminology people use. I assume dating back to the Bloch equations, which was where Bloch just called these two things gamma 1 and gamma 2. Gamma 1 is associated with T1 in the same way that if you write down an exponential process, the lifetime is the inverse of the rate. So T1 and gamma 1 are just the inverse of each other. T1 equals 1 over gamma 1, where gamma 1 is the decay rate and T1 is the lifetime. And similarly, T2 is... So I assume that's the historical origin of it. And so now it's been definitely assimilated by very many communities and quantum physics, this terminology, so it's good to learn it. And so the point I was trying to make was that if you're going to have transitions amongst the energy eigenlevels, then that necessarily implies some dephasing of the off diagonal, some loss of coherence of the off diagonal. But phase damping, on the other hand, you can just dephase without changing the populations. So basically, there are restrictions on complete positivity which demand this be true. Yes.
Regarding that matrix, am I correct in saying that we cannot? So the matrix behind you. Am I correct in saying that we cannot apply that successively? Because after one term.
Oh, you can.
But then aren't they entangled? Aren't environment and system entangled after one?
Yeah. So basically, so first of all, mathematically you can do it, and it's a well-defined map. But then you're asking, is it physically justified to do it? And that's actually an extremely deep question. And that boils down to the question of what is the nature of your environment. And I mean, this is a crucial question people face all the time when describing physical systems, is are we justified in this? And I'll touch on this again later in the lecture, under what assumptions that's true. But just to answer your question, to give you some immediate gratification, basically the assumption is you need an environment that's rich enough and complex enough and has enough internal dynamics that over some, if I'm looking at the system over some time tau, and I model that with this amplitude damping channel, clearly I've impacted the environment. I've written some information onto the environment. And now if that piece of the environment is still hanging around for the next time step,
then almost certainly the mathematical operation of applying them won't describe the physical situation because we have this entanglement now. But if your environment dynamics is very rich and has fast internal dynamics and it's a big environment, then what happens is the local system over time tau has moved over somewhere else and been replaced with new environment degrees of freedom that weren't there before. And so now when the same physical interaction, which is interacting with whatever is nearest to it, is now a fresh piece of the environment. And so you have this assumption that the environment's constantly providing fresh degrees of freedom so that you can avoid these assumptions of entanglement and or that they're negligible. And so the model we're using applies. And the process of proving conditions under which an environment that can be applied is known as deriving what's called the Lindblad form, which I'll show you today. And the Lindblad form and the assumptions that go into that, I mean, it's a pretty messy business, but basically it's tough to mathematically rigorously derive conditions under which it's true. We know that it's true physically because we see exponential processes all the time in the noise. But basically, it's called the Born-Markov approximation. So you take this huge Hilbert space for your environment, you give it some complicated degrees of freedom and interactions, and then the Born-Markov approximation is a way of saying, okay, well, I'm going to assume that the environment, the local environment, is memoryless at every coarse-grained timescale tau. So you have to introduce a coarse-graining in time. And I spend about 4 lectures deriving this in my Open Quantum Systems course. It's a very involved calculation. But of course, what happens is, in the 1950s, all the noise looked exponential because people were looking at systems on a very coarse time scale and the control was just so-so. But nowadays, with people doing very, very high precision experiments on individual atoms and individual superconducting qubits, we see non-Markovian effects all the time, and it's a major obstacle. And so people are trying to work on ways to overcome that and devise error correction techniques that work even when the noise is non-Markovian, and proving fault tolerance threshold theorems for quantum computing under the assumption the noise is no longer Markovian, no longer memoryless. And so that's a big area. Okay, this is always a disaster when I write on that board. So I'll move back over here where you all can see better. So continuing on with this phase damping discussion, I guess I had a little bit of room here, so let me just make use of it. So a simple model for phase damping then is the set of Krauss operators A0 equal to 1, 0, 0, 1 minus lambda, and A1 equal to 0, 0, 0, square root of lambda. With lambda in the interval 0, 1. And you can easily calculate what that does to the state. I'll leave that as an exercise for home. All it's going to do is introduce factors here which attenuate the off-diagonals and leave the diagonals invariant. But let me give you now a little bit of a physical model that would give rise to this phase damping channel. So a simple physical model for phase damping is that you imagine your output state, you have a collection of quantum systems, you have an ensemble of quantum systems that can be an ensemble in time or an ensemble in space. And we imagine that each one is subjected to a rotation R z
theta would be equal to e to the I theta sigma z. So it's a rotation by angle theta about the z-axis. It's a unitary operation. And then we have some probability distribution of thetas. So recall, I mentioned last class, in NMR, one has things like dephasing. In NMR, I mentioned how the fact is that the T2, you get more T2 than the minimum you get. So in optics, in the driven atom for spontaneous emission, one has essentially a T1 process due to spontaneous emission, and that gives rise to some dephasing, some T2. But that in NMR, one has more T2 than the minimum implied by spontaneous emission, implied by amplitude damping, because of additional noise effects. And one way to model that additional effect is because the physical ensemble, there's an inhomogeneity. So this angle theta, so physically, theta will be proportional to, this is a rotation about z, so I should have used a rotation about x, but physically theta might correspond to, is proportional to, say, omega naught, and you can have a distribution of magnetic fields. So the magnetic field times the coupling is what gives rise to omega naught, and you can have a probability distribution of, let's call it field strength probability of field strength omega naught over the ensemble. So in NMR, that's a liquid. It's a liquid, and so you have a physical ensemble. And then each spin in different pieces of that ensemble sees a slightly different magnetic field. And so that means it gets rotated by a slightly different amount than its neighbor. And we can model that with the probability distribution of rotations. So this is a convex combination of unitary rotations. And this is probably the simplest model of when you get a Krauss form, just from a probabilistic mixture of unitary processes in the system you're describing or measuring. And then you can show then that this gives rise to phase damping. And so just to make things concrete, let's choose P theta equal to e to the minus theta squared over 4 sigma. I don't know why there's a 4 there, but it doesn't really matter. 4 pi sigma. And then the resulting map is just rho 0, 0, e to the minus sigma, rho 0, 1, e to the minus sigma, rho 1, 0, rho 1, 1. And so if you'll see that this establishes a relationship between lambda and sigma. Any questions about this? Okay, there's one last thing I want to show you, which is continuous forms of open system dynamics. The Krauss form is great, except it's limited to a discrete time picture. And it's important to have a model in continuous time limit because in most experimental setups, time is a continuous parameter, and so you want some continuous description of what's going on. And so probably the most important model in this context is the Lindblad form. So let me kind of derive it for you. So I don't know, this is a kind of mathematics I think is really neat. So what we do is this. We want to define a what's called a quantum dynamical semigroup. So basically, we assume that we have some family of maps, lambda t, for t greater than or equal to 0, which satisfy the following properties. So first of all, we want, for every t, we want lambda t to be a CPTP map, which you'll see is basically saying that at every instant in time, we're expecting the environment to have no memory about the any memory in the environment won't affect the subsequent dynamics. We have a continuity condition. And here, one has a lot of freedom in defining the continuity condition, so we'll take the weakest one available, which is that the trace of lambda t rho against some observable A is a continuous function of t. For every A in BH. I don't want to answer Nicole's question about defining bounded operators right now, so I'll just change this to linear operators. So in the case of finite dimensional Hilbert space, all linear operators are bounded. But if you go to infinite dimensional systems, then you have unbounded operators and things get messy. And so let's just keep this clean and focus on finite dimensions. So I'll make this a finite dimensional Hilbert space to keep my life simple. Now let me just make a remark about notation, because you guys are new to completely positive maps. Now, traditionally, when you learn quantum mechanics, you start putting a hat on the operators to denote that they're operators, and so they're non-commutative. Now, when we go to describing completely positive maps, this is an operator acting on the space of operators. So rho is an operator acting on the vector space. A is an observable. It acts on the vector space. So it takes vectors in the Hilbert space to other vectors in the Hilbert space. Lambda takes operators that act on the Hilbert space to other operators that act on the Hilbert space. So you have to get used to this idea, first of all, that the density operator is an operator that acts on the Hilbert space. It's not a vector in the Hilbert space. And now I'm throwing around the word the Hilbert space very cavalierly. The point is we have two Hilbert spaces. We have the Hilbert space of pure quantum states, which is CD. And then we have the operators, the linear operators, this L is the linear operators acting on CD. Now, as I mentioned to you in a previous lecture, and this is worth repeating because it's so important, let me just make a side remark. So the linear operators on the Hilbert space themselves form a Hilbert space of dimension CD cross CD. And it's a Hilbert space because it's complete in the norm under the inner product trace of A dagger B is equal to the inner product of A
and B, where A and B are both elements of L, CD.
So now the fact that our density operators are clearly in this class, as well as our observables, and that we can form a Hilbert space on them, means that this operator lambda, our completely positive map, is also just an operator. It's an operator acting on this Hilbert space. But because of the confusion, people tend to call this operator a super operator. Because just to denote that it's acting not on the Hilbert space of pure quantum states, but on the Hilbert space of density operators. So just that's the notation and meaning. So basically, so lambda then, which acts on LCD and takes it to other linear operators on LCD, is an operator on LCD, which is a Hilbert space. CD squared, and it's sometimes called, so lambda is sometimes called a super operator. For conceptual clarity. Yeah?
So my question is about the continuity condition.
Oh boy, all right.
Does A have to depend on time, or is that arbitrary?
Well, no, A is fixed. So A is just some fixed operator. The time variation is in lambda.
So we're in the Schrodinger picture.
Yeah, we're in the Schrodinger picture. Now, I don't know why you're asking this, but it's funny that you do, because normally people state the continuity equation in the Heisenberg picture, and I've translated it in the Schrodinger picture just to avoid the overhead of introducing the Heisenberg picture. Because you can do basically, just like the unitary operator has, you know, the adjoint of the unitary operator gives you the evolution in the Heisenberg picture. Similarly, you can define an adjoint of the super operator, which is associated with, here then you have trace of rho lambda dagger acting on A. And then that's essentially the Heisenberg picture. And there are subtleties, and conditions of continuity change normally when you do that, but in this special case, I'm almost 100% certain the continuity conditions don't change, because it turns out the system is so highly constrained that all the different forms of continuity, like strong, weak, and all these different, they all reduce to the same condition for this setup. So, yes?
We've seen there's a Hilbert space of vectors, there's a Hilbert space for the operators that act on vectors. Is there a Hilbert space for the lambdas?
What are lambdas?
Sorry.
Oh, capital lambda?
Yes.
So basically, any operator on a finite dimensional Hilbert space, you can construct a Hilbert space of those operators, and it just you just keep squaring the dimension, and it's an infinite regress. We don't know of much operational value in doing that, but what am I saying? So actually, one of the things I've done, kind of a research contribution, was develop this theory of twirling, which is a way of modifying super operators to put them in a canonical form. And the twirling operation is an operation acting on the super operators. So Aram Harrow calls them super duper operators, which I like.
So we're talking about three spaces. One is the Hilbert space for the vectors, one is for operators on vectors, and the other is for operators on operators.
Yeah, so you have to keep all of these clear. And then let me just say one more thing. So the only representation you've seen for super operators is this Krauss representation, where we write it out this way. But for those of you who are, you know, comfortable with linear algebra, you realize, well, now that we've recognized that lambda is just the Hilbert space operator, full stop, then we can actually represent it in all the ways we normally represent operators on a Hilbert space. We just construct a matrix representation by taking, you can actually construct a representation of lambda as just a matrix with respect to the inner product trace of some basis B alpha lambda B beta, which you can think of as B alpha lambda B beta in Dirac notation. And therefore, we get a matrix representation of an arbitrary superoperator in this way. And in a way, that's a much more natural way to describe superoperators. But due to historical reasons, people are used to thinking about them as Krauss forms. So I found the Krauss form actually to be the least useful representation of superoperators, but it's also the most commonly used one. So what can you do? Okay, so now let's return. Let's step away from these side remarks and just return to our description of the quantum dynamical semigroup. So we have a family of CPTP maps, which have a reasonable continuity condition, and which also have the following semigroup property. So you can think of this just as matrix multiplication. So if you think of lambda as a matrix in the sense I wrote there, then this is just matrix multiplication. You can also think of it as composition. So you would take this output state row and apply a new set of Krauss operators to it, representing the process T. And so you can think of this as composition or as matrix multiplication, depending on what picture you're working in. And we also require that at time t equals 0, that lambda is equal to the identity superoperator. So the identity superoperator is the operator which takes an arbitrary input state rho and returns it exactly the same input operator. So this isn't the identity state. This is the identity superoperator. Actually, what set me off on this digression was the fact that I'm using 1 hat for rho, 1 hat for A, 1 hat for lambda. What people sometimes do is they put 2 hats here to remind you that lambda is a different dimension than A. So of course, this is lambda acting on rho, so the output is something with a single hat, and that's why you can multiply it by A. So I should put 2 hats here to be consistent. Yes?
Would it be right to say that lambda acts on the dual of the dual space?
I don't think so. No. So lambda acts on operators acting on the Hilbert space.
Can we understand this in terms of dual spaces in any way?
I don't think it's related to dual spaces. Maybe in some sense you could, in this picture, if you interpret this as an inner product, which it is, then the output state rho prime is the dual vector in this inner product. So whenever you have an inner product like this or like this, this is the dual vector, and this is the dual space, and this is the vector. And so here in this picture, lambda is generating a dual vector in this Hilbert space. Maybe that's what you're thinking of. So that's certainly true. But lambda in and of itself, stepping aside from this particular instance of it, lambda doesn't have anything to do with dual spaces. Yeah?
It is possible to ask for a weaker condition in continuity, just continuity for observables, not linear operators.
I think that because you can have a basis for the space for finite dimensions now, which where everything's simple, you can write down a basis for the linear operator space in terms of Hermitian operators, and you just allow complex coefficients. And so by linearity, that would be no weaker of a condition than this. This is actually the weakest continuity condition you can use. You can define this also in terms of much stronger continuity conditions, but as I was mentioning to Tibra, they all end up being equivalent in this context.
It's a condition free the Markovian assumption.
Yes, actually. So condition three is assuming that I can just apply lambda t and I don't have to worry about the fact that the second, the time evolution for the second time period t, so here, this happens first, then this. The fact that I'm claiming I can model the second evolution with a CPTP map is assuming that it's Markovian. And this is called a semigroup property because remember how you define a group. You have an identity element. Multiply two elements in the group, you get another element, or in the set, you get another element. And then every element has to have an inverse in the set. And that defines a group. A semigroup, you drop the last condition. So when you multiply two elements, you get a new element. You have an identity element, but the inverses don't exist necessarily. And that's because this is not a reversible process. So we're describing, this is essentially, this is a model for irreversible processes. For irreversible processes, so it's not a group, but a semigroup. Okay, so I'm now going to show you, given that we have such a model, how can we represent it? Yes?
So when you say it's irreversible and it's a semigroup, does it mean that there are some transform involved? That some for some lambda, the inverse is not present in the set, in this group?
For some, not all. I mean, obviously lambda zero identity has its own inverse, but yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, essentially what these maps are going to do is they're going to contract the block sphere. Well, sorry, these are defined for arbitrary dimensions. But in the case of a single qubit, they generally rotate and contract the block sphere, so which means we're losing purity. And there's no equivalent process that would expand out where you would lose normalization. It would be physically meaningless to have an inverse in this context. Yes?
From a philosophical point of view, are we kind of introducing an arrow of time here?
Yes, absolutely.
Because previous to this, we had a formalism where everything you could time reverse, right? And now we're putting it.
Exactly. It's deeply, I mean, there's a deep relation to the fact that, I mean, the point is we see irreversibility in nature, and now we're just coming up with a phenomenological model to get that. As I mentioned in answer to another question, you can derive specific conditions under which this model holds when you look, when you're looking at an exact reversible description on the full Hilbert space. And it's hard to get that asymmetry out of the reversible picture. Okay, so then so one can prove that for any one parameter that for quantum dynamical semigroups, one has any lambda t in the semigroup can be expressed as the exponential of a generator L times time. Which is equivalent to saying that d rho by dt is equal to L acting on rho where L is called the Lindblatian. Or the Lindblad operator. And one can also prove that that Lindblad operator admits a decomposition. And this is what you normally see. And at least, well, you can always express L as a contribution due to the reversible unitary dynamics. Here we just recover, I think my h bars are 1 now, so here I'm setting h bar equal to 1. Plus something called the dissipator, where the dissipator has the form . So in infinite dimensions, it's a bit more subtle. We have to be careful about unbounded operators, as usual, which we won't get into. But that's what I wanted to show you. So this is a very, very common model of continuous time open system dynamics, which is valid in the Markovian limit.
So RAL.
Well, I shouldn't have called them A's. I think, well, they're... So cross operators are just linear operators on the Hilbert space. And similarly, these are just some linear operators on the Hilbert space. So in the sense that they're the same mathematical object, but they have a different physical meaning here. So I wouldn't, you know, don't take the cross operators associated with phase damping and substitute them into here and expect to get the right physics. So they're mathematically the same, but have a different physical meaning. In the sense that the representation of, say, amplitude damping, and in fact, this is another thing I wanted to suggest as a tutorial or problem, or assignment problem, is what you can do is derive, given the amplitude damping and the phase damping Krauss operators, you can take a continuous time limit and derive the Lindblad operators associated with those physical processes. So I don't know if that would be better as a tutorial than an assignment, because the answer is in my course notes. So
I have another problem which derives the classical damped harmonic oscillator from the Lindblad.
So again, this is valid in the Markovian limit, where the environment isn't continuously, it doesn't have memory effects that are affecting your future system evolution. Any questions about this? Okay, and then what I'll do tomorrow for our last lecture is go through some simple examples in quantum information that illustrate this various effects that are kind of fun and interesting. Like, we'll go over quantum teleportation and things like that. And I meant to ask you guys, actually, so what fraction of you, I mean, I guess you don't have to have your minds made up yet, because you're still starting your kind of, you know, graduate studies, but What fraction of you are interested in the different areas of research that are covered here? So I guess, you know, there's gravity, there's quantum information, there's quantum foundations, there's condensed matter, there's particle physics, there's cosmology. So I'm just curious to see, just by a show, let's, I guess you can vote for more than one. So how many of you are interested in relativity? When I say, obviously everything is interesting, but interested in pursuing it, considering pursuing it for the studies. So relativity, general relativity, particle physics, quantum information, quantum foundations. All right, so we've got a pretty good mix. Condensed matter and cosmology. And what are the other categories I've missed? String theory, of course. Of course, string theory. How many of you are interested in string theory? A few of you? All right, so you've got a pretty diverse group here then, yeah. Okay, great. Well, thanks for your attention, and I'll see you tomorrow.